8. Evie's rules were 1. Stay undercover and no killing until daylight. 2. Cut open the cocoons enclosing Kaylee and Mora. 3. Enjoy life.
Yeah, that's fine, Angel said. But are you sure Mora and Kay won't kill me while I'm enjoying life?
Pretty sure, Evie said.
Good enough,
Angel said. Open her cell, Evie said, and a line of rats emerged from the hole by the shower alcove. The first one stopped at the base of Angel's cell door. The second climbed atop the first, the third atop the second. A tower formed, gray rat body stacked on gray rat body like hideous ice cream scoops. Evie gasped when she felt the bottom rat suffocate. Oh, mother, she said. I am so, so sorry.
Look at this wonderful circus shit here,
Angel was entranced.
You could make money at this, sister, you know it.
The topmost rat was the smallest, still a pup. It squeezed into the keyhole and Evie controlled its tiny paws, searching through the mechanisms, investing it with a strength that no rat had ever possessed before. The cell door opened. Angel fetched a couple of towels from the shower, fluffed them up, laid them on the bunk, and draped a blanket over them. She closed the cell door behind her. If anyone looked in, it would appear that she had finally lost the fight and fallen asleep. She started up the corridor, headed for Sea Wing, where most of the cocoon's sleepers now resided. Goodbye, Angel, Evie called.
Yeah,
Angel said.
See ya.
She hesitated with her hand on the door.
You hear screaming somewhere far off?
Evie did. It was, she knew, Selectman Bert Miller, blatting about the bullet wound in his leg. His wailing carried inside the prison through the ventilation ducts. Angel didn't need to concern herself with that.
Don't worry,
Evie said. It's just a man.
Oh,
Angel said and left. 9. Jeanette had been sitting against the wall across from the cells during Angel and Evie's conversation, listening and observing. Now she turned to Damien, years dead and buried over 100 miles away, and yet also sitting beside her. He had a clutch head screwdriver in his thigh and he was bleeding onto the floor, although the blood didn't feel like anything to Jeanette, not even wet, which was strange because she was sitting in a pool of it.
Did you see that? She asked. Those rats?
Yeah, Damien said. His tone went high-pitched and squeaky, his imitation of her voice.
I see those ratsies, Jeanie baby.
Ugh, Jeanette thought. He had been all right when he first reappeared in her life, but now he was becoming irritable.
There's rats just like that chew on my corpse because of how you killed me, Jeanie baby.
I'm sorry. She touched her face. It felt like she was crying, but her face was dry. Jeanette scratched at her forehead, digging the nails in, trying to find some pain. She hated being crazy.
Come on, check it out.
Damien moved over, bringing his face up close.
They chewed me right down to the marrow.
His eyes were black sockets. The rats had eaten the eyeballs. Jeanette didn't want to look, wanted to close her own eyes, but if she did, she knew sleep would be waiting.
What kind of a mother lets her son's daddy be done by like this? Kills him and lets the rats chew on him like he was a goddamn butterfinger.
Jeanette, Evie said. Hey, over here.
Never mind that bitch, Jeanie, Damien said.
A rat pup fell out of his mouth as he spoke. It landed in Jeanette's lap. She screamed and slapped at it, but it wasn't there.
I need your attention. Eyes on me, moron.
Evie said, I'm glad you stayed awake, Jeanette. I'm glad you didn't listen to me. Something's happening on the other side, and, well, I thought I'd be happy about it, but maybe I'm getting soft in my old age. On the off chance this thing goes on long enough, I'd like for there to be a fair hearing.
What are you talking about? Jeanette's throat ached. Her everything ached.
Do you want to see Bobby again?
Of course I want to see him, Jeanette said, ignoring Damien. It was getting easier to do that. Of course I want to see my boy.
All right, then, listen carefully. There are secret ways between the two worlds, tunnels. Each woman who goes to sleep passes through one of them, but there's another, a very special one, that begins at a very special tree. That's the only one that goes both ways. Do you understand?
No.
You will, Evie said. There's a woman on the other side of that tunnel, and she's going to close it unless someone stops her. I respect her position. I think it's perfectly valid. The male species has performed abysmally on this side of the tree. No amount of grade inflation can alter that conclusion, but everyone deserves a say. One woman, one vote. Elaine Nutting can't be allowed to make the decision for everyone. Evie's face was at the bars of her cell. Verdant tendrils had grown up around her temples. Her eyes were auburn-colored tiger eyes. Moths had gathered in her hair, collecting themselves into a fluttering band. She was a monster, Jeanette thought. And beautiful.
What does that have to do with Bobby?
If the tree burns, the tunnel closes. No one can ever come back. Not you, not any other woman, Jeanette. The end will become inevitable.
Nope, nope, nope. It's already inevitable, Damien said.
Go to sleep, Jeanie.
Can you just shut up? You're dead, Jeanette screamed at him. I'm sorry I killed you and I would do anything to take it back, but you are cruel to me and it's done. So will you just shut your fucking mouth?
The declaration echoed around the narrow confines of A-Wing. Damien was not there.
Well put, Evie said. Courageous.
Now listen to me, Jeanette. I want you to close your eyes. You'll go through the tunnel, your tunnel, but you won't remember. This part Jeanette thought she understood.
Because I'll be sleeping?
Exactly. Once you're on the other side, you're going to feel better than you have in quite a long time. I want you to follow the fox. He'll take you where you need to go. Remember, Bobby and tree, the one depends on the other. Jeanette let her eyes shut. Bobby, she reminded herself. Bobby and the tree and the tunnel that went both ways. The one some woman named Elaine wanted to close by an act of burning. Follow the fox. She counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and everything was the same. Except for Evie, that was, who had turned into a green lady, as if she were a tree herself. Then she felt a tickle along her cheek, a swab of the lightest lace. 10. After the shot, they heard Bert Miller bellow and wail and keep wailing as his companion dragged him away. Clint borrowed Willie Burke's rifle scope to take a look. The yellow-clad figure on the ground was clutching his thigh, and the other guy was hauling him underneath his armpits.
Good. Thanks.
Clint returned the rifle to Wettermore. Willie Burke was eyeing both of them with careful consideration. Part admiration and part caution. Clint went back inside. The rear door that led into the small gymnasium was propped open with a brick. To lower visibility from the outside, they had trimmed the lights to just the red-tinted emergency bulbs. These cast small scarlet spots around the edges of the hardwood floor where inmates played half-court basketball. Clint stopped under the hoop and steadied himself against the padded wall. His heart was pumping. He wasn't scared, he wasn't happy, but he was here. Clint warned himself about the euphoria he was feeling, but it didn't temper the pleasant thrumming in his limbs. He was either becoming walled off from himself or returning to himself. He didn't know which. What he knew was that he had the milkshake, and Geary wasn't going to take it away from him. That Geary was wrong almost didn't matter. Aurora wasn't a virus. It was an enchantment. And Evie Black was like no woman, no human, who had ever existed. You couldn't fix something that was beyond human understanding with a hammer, which was what Frank Geary and Terry Coombs and the other men outside the prison presumed they could do. This required a different approach. It was obvious to Clint and should have been to them because they weren't all stupid men, but for some reason it wasn't, and that meant he was going to have to use his own hammer to block theirs. They started it. How childish. And how true. The cycle of this logic went around on rusty, squalling wheels. Clint punched the padded wall several times and wished it were a man under his knuckles. He thought of pyrotherapy, the fever cure. For a while, it had been cutting-edge treatment, except giving malaria to your patients was awfully heavy medicine. Sometimes it saved them, and sometimes it finished them. Was Evie a pyrotherapist or the pyrotherapy? Was she possibly doctor and treatment both? Or, by ordering Billy Wettermore to fire that shot to the leg of Selectman Burt Miller, had he himself administered the first dose? 11. Footsteps clicked across the floor from the direction of the gymnasium. Angel was just leaving the abandoned booth with a set of cell keys. She gripped them in her right hand, the longest key protruding between the knuckles of her index finger and her middle finger. She had once stabbed a sloppy old cowboy in an Ohio parking lot in the ear with a sharpened key. It had not killed the cowboy, but he hadn't enjoyed it much. Angel, feeling kind, had merely taken from the man his wallet, his dime store wedding ring, his scratch tickets, and silver belt buckle. She had allowed him to keep his life. Dr. Norcross walked by the glassed wall of the booth without stopping. Angel Wade coming up behind him and plunging the key in the untrustworthy quack's jugular. She loved the idea. Unfortunately, she had made a promise to Evie not to kill anyone until daylight, and Angel was profoundly wary of crossing the witch. She allowed the doctor to pass. Angel headed for Sea Wing and the cell that was home to Mora and Kaylee. The shape that was clearly Mora, short and stout, lay on the outside of the bottom bunk, where someone had placed her after she had gone night-night in A-Wing. Kaylee was on the inside of the bunk. Angel had no clue what Evie had meant when she said that their souls were dead, but it encouraged caution. She used the tip of a key to slice through the webbing that covered Mora's face. The material separated with a purr, and Mora's pudgy, red-cheeked features emerged. They could have served as the model for an illustration on the box of some down-home brand sold in little backwater stores. Mama Mora's Cornbread, or Dunbarton Soothing Syrup. Angel jumped away into the hall, ready to flee if Mora went for her. The woman on the bed sat up slowly.
Mora?
Mora Dunbarton blinked. She stared at Angel. Her eyes were entirely pupil. She pulled her right arm free of its cocoon, then her left arm, and then placed her hands together in her crinkly lap. After Mora had sat like that for a couple of minutes, Angel eased into the cell again.
I won't just harm you if you move on me, Momo. I'll kill you.
The woman sat quietly, black eyes fixed on the wall. Angel used the key to slice the webbing that covered Kaylee's face. As quickly as before, she darted back out of the cell and into the hall. The same process repeated itself, Kaylee slipping down the top half of her cocoon as though it were a dress, looking with eyes that were all black. Shoulder to shoulder, the two women sat, torn webs hanging over their hair, their chins, their necks. They looked like ghosts in some cheap traveling carny's haunted house.
You gals all right?
Angel asked. They made no reply. They did not appear to be breathing.
You know what all you're supposed to do?
Angel asked, less nervous now but curious. They said nothing. No reflection of any kind stirred in their black eyes. A faint scent of turned, damp earth emanated from the two women. Angel thought she wished she hadn't. This is how the dead sweat.
Okay. Good.
Either they would do something or they wouldn't.
I'll leave you gals to it.
She thought of adding something of an encouraging nature, like, go get 'em, and decided not to. Angel went to the wood shop and used the keys to unlock the tools. She tucked a small hand drill into her waistband, a chisel into one sock, and a screwdriver into the other. Then she lay down on her back beneath a table and watched a dark window for the first sign of light. She didn't feel a bit sleepy. 12. Filaments spun and whirled around Jeanette's face, splitting and falling and rising, burying her features. Clint knelt beside her, wanting to hold her hand, but not daring. You were a good person, he told her. Your son loved you. She is a good person. Her son does love her. She is not dead. She only sleeps. Clint went to the bars of Evie's cell. So you say, Evie. She sat on her cot. You look like you're getting your second wind, Clint. Her bearing, the downward tilt of her head, glossy black hair falling across the side of her face, was melancholy. You can still hand me over, but not for much longer. No, he said. What a voice on that man you had Weddermore shoot. I could hear him all the way over here. Her tone wasn't goading. It was reflective. People don't like to be shot. It hurts. Maybe you didn't know that. The municipal building was destroyed tonight. The ones who did it blamed it on you. Sheriff Coombs took a walk. Frank Geary will bring his people in the morning. Does any of that surprise you, Clint? It didn't. You're very good at getting what you want, Evie. I'm not going to congratulate you, though. Now think of Lila and the others in the world beyond the tree. Please believe me, they're doing well there. They're building something new, something fine. And there will be men, better men, raised from infancy by women in a community of women. Men who will be taught to know themselves and to know their world. Clint said, their essential nature will assert itself in time. Their maleness. One will raise a fist against another. Believe me, Evie, you're looking at a man who knows. Indeed so, Evie agreed. But such aggression isn't sexual nature. It's human nature. If you ever doubt the aggressive capacity of women, ask your own Officer Lampley. She'll be asleep somewhere by now, Clint said. Evie smiled as if she knew better. I am not so foolish as to promise you the women on the far side of the tree have utopia. What they will have is a better start and a good chance of a better finish. You are standing in the way of that chance. You and only you of all the men on Earth. I need you to know that. If you let me die, those women will be set free to live lives of their own choosing. Lives of your choosing, Evie. His voice sounded parched to his own ears. The being on the other side of the cell door tapped a rhythm on the frame of the cot with her fingertips. Linny Mars was in the police station when it was destroyed. She's gone forever. She didn't get a choice. You took it from her, Clint said. We could go on like this forever. He said, she said, the oldest story in the universe. Evie left the cell door and sat on her cot. Go fight your war, Clint. That's one thing men know how to do. Make me see another sunset, if you can. Chapter 13. 1. As the rim of the sun appeared over the woods behind Dueling Correctional, a line of bulldozers clanked up West Lavin, end to end. All three were Caterpillars, two D-9s and a big D-11. The assault team was 18 men in total. 15 of them were with the bulldozers, headed for the front gate. 3 of them were advancing around the backside of the prison fence. They'd left Selectman Miller at the roadblock with a bottle of Vicodin and his bandaged leg propped on a camp chair. Frank had organized 12 in the forward group, his dirty dozen, into 3 quartets. Each quartet, in vests and masks, hunkered behind a bulldozer, using it for cover. The windows and grills of the dozers had been jury-rigged with scrap steel. Retired Deputy Jack Albertson drove the first in line, Coach J.T. Whitstock drove the second, and the former Golden Gloves boxer, Carson Struthers, drove the third. Frank was with Albertson's bulldozer. The men in the woods were Deputy Elmore Pearl, the deer hunter Drew T. Barry, his office now in ruins, and Don Peters. 2. Clint spotted the bulldozers from the high window on B-Wing and bolted for the stairs, pulling on his bulletproof vest as he went. "Have fun getting fucked, Doc," Scott Hughes called cheerfully as he ran past. "Like they'll give you a pass if they get in," Clint said. This wiped the smile from Scott's face. Clint hurried down Broadway, stopping to put his head in the visitor's room. "Rand, they're coming. Lay down the tear gas." "Okay," said Rand from the family alcove at the end of the room, and calmly donned the gas mask he had at the ready. Clint continued to the security station at the main door. The station was your basic bulletproof toll booth where visitors were required to check in. The little room had a long-facing window and a drawer for passing IDs and valuables through to the officer on duty. There was a communications board like the ones in the booth and the gatehouse, with monitors that could flip through views of the various inner and outer areas of the prison. Tig was at the board. Clint rapped on the door and Tig opened it. "What have you got on the monitors?" "Sunrise is flaring the lenses. If there's men behind the bulldozers, I can't see them yet." They had 8 or 9 gas grenades to go with the launcher. On the central monitor, below the spirals of glare, Clint saw several of these strike the parking lot and spew white fumes to mix with the Terry smoke still leaking from the tires. He told Tig to keep watching and ran on. His next destination was the break room. Jared and Michaela were at a table with a deck of cards and cups of coffee. "Make yourselves scarce. It's starting." Michaela toasted him with her cup.
"Sorry, Doc. I'm legal to vote and everything. I think I'll stick around. Who knows, there might be a Pulitzer in my future."
Jared's color was chalky. He looked from Michaela to his father. "Fine," Clint said. "Far be it for me to abridge the freedom of the press. Jared, hide, and don't tell me where." He jogged on before his son could respond. His breath was short by the time he reached the rear door that opened near the shed and the fields. The reason that, until the morning of Aurora, he'd never before suggested to Lila that they should go running was because he hadn't wanted her to have to limit her pace for him. It would have been embarrassing. What was the root here, vanity or laziness? Clint promised himself to give the question real consideration when he had a free second, and, if he should be so lucky as to live through the morning and ever get to speak to his wife again, possibly to repeat his proposal that they take up jogging together. 3 bulldozers on the road, Clint announced as he emerged outside.
"We know," Willie Burke said.
He walked over to Clint from his spot behind the shed. There was a weird contrast between his bulletproof vest and his festive red suspenders, now lolling in loops at his hips.
"Tig radioed. Billy's going to hold tight here, watch the north fence. I'm going to saddle on up along this wall to the corner and see if I can get a few clean shots. You're welcome to join me, but you'll need one of these."
He handed Clint a gas mask and put on his own. 3. At the 90-degree turn from the road to the gate, Frank pounded the metal plate over the door, a signal to Albertson to hang a right. Jack did so, slowly and carefully. The men slipped back further, keeping the mass of metal in front of them at all times as it swung around. Frank was wearing a vest, and he had a Glock in his right hand. He could see licks of smoke spilling down the road. This was expected. He'd heard the pops of the gas grenades being fired. They couldn't have too many. There had been a lot more masks than grenades in the armaments room of the sheriff's station. The first bulldozer completed its adjustment, and the four men climbed on the back, pressed together shoulder to shoulder. In the bulldozer cockpit, Jack Albertson was safe behind the steel blade, which was raised to the upper position, therefore blocking the window. He gave it plenty of gas as it headed for the gate. Frank used his walkie, although not everyone in his attack force had them. All of this had been done on the fly.
"Get ready, everyone. This is going to happen."
And please, he thought, with as little bloodshed as possible. He was already two men down, and the attack hadn't even started. 4.
"What do you think?" Clint asked Willie.
On the other side of the double fences, the first bulldozer, blade high, was crunching forward. For a half second, there'd been a glimpse of movement slipping around to the back of the machine. Willie didn't respond. The old moonshiner was revisiting an unnamed square meter of hell in Southeast Asia in 68. Everything had been still. Swamp water up to his Adam's apple. A layer of smoke closing out the sky, him sandwiched in the middle. Everything had been so still, and a bird, red and blue and yellow and massive, eagle-sized, had floated up beside him, dead, its eye clouded. The creature was so vivid and so incongruous in the strange light. Its glorious feathers had grazed Willie's shoulder, and the faint current had drawn it away, and it had vanished back into the smoke. Once he had told his sister about that. "Never saw a bird like that before. Not the whole time I was there. Never saw one since, either, of course. I wonder sometimes if it was the last of its kind." The Alzheimer's had taken most of what made her herself by then, but there had been a small piece left, and she had said, "Maybe it was just hurt, Willie." And Willie had said to her, "I sure love you, you know." His sister had blushed. The dozer blade hit the middle of the fence with a rattling crash. The lynx bowed inward before the whole section tore free of the ground and flopped back against the second layer of fence across the median. Ghosts of tear gas broke across the front of the bulldozer as it ground forward, bashing against the second fence with the tangled fragment of the first. The inner fence buckled and collapsed, the bulldozer jouncing over the debris. It continued across the smoke-filled parking lot, a length of fencing stuck shrieking under its nose. The second and third bulldozers followed the first through the gap. A brown shoe, visible behind the rear left corner of the first bulldozer, appeared in Willie's sight. He fired. A man shouted and fell out from behind the bulldozer, one pinwheeling arm casting off a shotgun. It was a bandy-legged little guy wearing a gas mask and a vest. Willie wouldn't have known it was Pudge Marone, saloon keeper of the Squeaky Wheel, even if Pudge's face had been visible. Willie hadn't drunk in bars, not for years. While the man's torso was covered, his legs and arms were not, and that was just fine, because Willie did not want to kill anyone if he could help it. He shot again, not quite where he wanted, but close enough, and the .223 caliber bullet, expressed by an M4 assault rifle that had been the property of the dueling sheriff's department until the previous day, blew off Pudge Marone's thumb. An arm reached out from behind the bulldozer to assist the prone man, an understandable and perhaps commendable attempt, though definitely unwise. The arm in question belonged to retired Deputy Nate McGee, who, having lost over $100 playing dice on the tarmac of Route 31 the previous evening, had soothed himself with a pair of false thoughts. One, that if he'd known for certain that Mrs. McGee might someday reawaken, he wouldn't have bet at all. And two, that at least he had used up his bad luck for the week. Not so. Willie shot a third time, catching the elbow of the reaching arm. There was another shout, and McGee tumbled from behind the bulldozer. Willie squeezed off 4 more quick shots, testing the steel plate that had been mounted over the bulldozer's grill, and heard them zing off uselessly. Frank leaned out from the cover of the first bulldozer with a pistol and fired a series of rapid shots at Willie. In 1968, Willie might have been able to judge by the angle of Geary's arm that his aim would be way off, and thus stayed in position and taken him out. But 1968 was 50 years ago, and getting shot at was something you lost your coziness with pretty swiftly. Willie and Clint scooted to cover. As Jack Albertson's bulldozer rolled through the tangles of tear gas and black smoke, straight on for the RV and the front doors, the debris under its nose grinding, the second bulldozer, driven by Coach Whitstock, barreled through the hole in the fence. Like Albertson before him and Carson Struthers behind him, Coach Whitstock's blade was raised for protection. He could hear the shots, could hear the shouts, but he couldn't see Nate McGee clutching his elbow on the ground in front of him, and when the bulldozer rolled over the disabled man, Coach Whitstock assumed it was just one of the burned tires that the machine's crawlers were climbing. He whooped. He was breaking through just like he taught his linebackers to do, reckless and relentless. From his vantage at the window in the visitor's room, Rand waited to fire on the first bulldozer until it was halfway between the gatehouse and the front doors. His shot struck plating here and there, ricocheting off without effect. Pete Ordway, the Whitstock boys, and Dan Treat, under cover of the second bulldozer, found themselves confronted with the crushed corpse of Nate McGee. The dead man's gas mask was full of blood, and his torso had burst out around the straps of his vest. Gore sprayed up from the crawler treads. Shreds of skin flapped like streamers. Roop Whitstock screamed and leaped away from the mess, clearing himself of the viscera, but putting himself in Rand's line of fire. Rand's first shot missed his target's head by an inch, the second by half an inch. Rand swore at himself and put his third shot square in the middle of the man's back. The slug lodged itself in the bulletproof vest the target was wearing and bowed him over. He threw his arm skyward like a fan in a stadium doing the wave. Rand shot a fourth time, lower. It hit the target in the buttocks and sent him sprawling. Deputy Treat was not fazed. Treater, only a year late of the 82nd Airborne, still possessed the relative comfort with being shot at that Willie Burke had lost long ago. He hopped off Dozer 2 without a second thought. He was relieved, in fact, to settle into military mode. Action was a break from the untenable reality of his daughter, Alice, at that second propped at her play table in their apartment, wrapped up in white fibers, when she ought to have just been getting up for another day of second grade. And it was a break from the thought of his year-old son, currently in a makeshift daycare run by men. Free of cover, Treat returned suppression fire with an M4 he'd recovered on Route 31. At the window, Rand dropped to his knees on the table he had been standing atop. Concrete fragments rained down his neck and back. Treater hoisted Roop Whitstock and pulled him to safety behind a stack of smoldering tires. Dozer 1 crashed into the rear end of the Fleetwood RV, slamming its hood against the front doors of the prison in an explosion of glass. 5. Jared sat on the floor of the laundry room while Michaela piled sheets around him, constructing a mound to hide him. "I feel stupid," Jared said. "You don't look stupid," Michaela said, which wasn't true. She fluttered a sheet above his head. "I feel like a pussy." Michaela hated that word. Even as she heard more shots ring out, it touched a nerve. A pussy was supposed to be soft, and although Michaela possessed one, there was nothing particularly soft about the rest of her. Janice Coates had not raised her to be a softie. She flipped up the sheet and gave Jared a hard, but not too hard, slap across the cheek. "Hey!" He put a hand to his face. "Don't say that." "Say what?" "Don't say pussy when it means weak. If your mother didn't teach you better than that, she should have." Michaela dropped the sheet over his face. 6.
It is a fucking crime that someone is not filming this for fucking reality TV, Lo said.
Eye to the scope of the bazooka, he had seen the second bulldozer squash the poor sucker who had fallen in front of the treads, seen the Rambo guy jump out from behind the second dozer, start blasting, and rescue another guy. He then witnessed, not without a mixture of wonder and glee, the first bulldozer as it smashed the RV into an accordion in front of the prison doors. It was a stellar conflict, and it was only going to get better once they spiced the soup with 3 or 4 bazooka shells.
When do we do our thing? May asked.
Soon as the cops have wore themselves out a bit more.
How are we going to be sure we got Kitty, Lo? That place must be full of slags and cocoons.
Lo didn't appreciate his brother's last-minute naysaying.
We probably won't be absolutely sure, May, but we are going to fire all these shells and blow the fuck out of the place, so I like our chances. To a certain extent, I suppose we're just going to have to hope for the best. Now, are we going to enjoy this or not? Or would you rather that I do all the shooting?
Come on, Lo, I didn't say that, protested May. Be fair.
7. On level 32 of Boomtown, little pink spiders began to invade Evie's field of stars, triangles, and burning orbs. The spiders doused the orbs and turned them into the irritating, sparkling blue stars that clogged up all the works. Booger. In A-Wing, the sound of the gunfire echoed piercingly. Evie was undisturbed. She had seen and heard men killing on numerous occasions. The pink spiders did bother her, though.
So evil, she said to no one,
sliding her colorful shapes around, searching for connections. Evie was extremely relaxed. As she played with the phone, she floated on her back a couple of centimeters above the cot. 8. Bushes twitched on the opposite side of the north fence, directly across from Billy Wettermore's position in the alley behind the garden shed. He unleashed a dozen rounds into the mass of greenery where the twitch had come from. The bushes shook and trembled. Drew T. Barry, a crafty insurance man who always kept to the most risk-averse course, wasn't anywhere near Billy's line of fire. Instead, with the prudence that not only made him Dueling's first stop for all your indemnification needs, but also an excellent deer hunter, willing to take his time to get an ideal shot, he had halted the other two men, Pearl and Peters, in the woods behind the prison gymnasium. Peters had told him that the rear door to the prison was on the west wall of the gym. The reaction produced by the rock that Drew had thrown into the brush close to that spot had told them a lot. Yes, there must be a door, and yes, it was definitely defended.
Deputy?
Drew T. Barry asked. They were crouched behind an oak. 15 feet or so ahead of them, bits of leaf were still drifting down from where the gunfire had torn up the foliage. To judge by the sound, the shooter was perhaps 30 or 40 yards beyond the interior fence, near the wall of the prison.
What?
Don Peters replied. Sweat streaked his flushed face. He had been lugging the duffel bag with their masks and the bolt cutters.
Not you, the real deputy, Drew T. Barry said.
Yeah?
Pearl nodded at him.
If I kill this guy shooting here, there's no chance of prosecution? Are you sure Geary and Coombs will swear we acted in the legal performance of our duties?
Yep, scout's honor.
Elmore Pearl raised his hand in the salute of his childhood. First 3 fingers raised, pinky held down by his thumb. Peters hawked some phlegm.
You need me to hustle back and fetch you a notary, Drew?
Drew T. Barry ignored this witless jibe, told them to stay put, and started backtracking into the woods, taking the northern incline in quick, quiet steps, his Weatherby rifle strapped to his back. 9. With the bulldozer halted, Frank continued to aim at the southwest corner of the prison, ready to pick off the rifleman there if he showed his face. The shooting had rattled him, had made it all real. He felt nauseated by the blood and the bodies on the ground, obscured and revealed as the clouds of tear gas shifted in the wind,
but his determination was still strong. He felt horror, but no remorse. His life was Nana's life, which made the risk acceptable. So he told himself. Kronsky joined him.
Hurry, Frank said. The sooner this is over, the better.
You got a point there, Mr. Man,
Kronsky said, on one knee with his backpack on the ground. He unzipped the pack, removed the bundle of dynamite, and snipped off 3/4 of the fuse. The armored door of the bulldozer swung open. Jack Albertson climbed down, carrying his old service weapon, a .38.
Cover us from yonder shit bird down the way,
Kronsky said to Albertson, pointing in the direction of Willie Burke's position. Then Kronsky turned to Frank.
Come on, and you'd best high-step it.
The two men hustled along the northwest wall of the prison, ducking low. Beneath the cutout window that was one of the defenders' firing points, Kronsky stopped. He had the dynamite in his right hand and a blue plastic lighter in the other. The defender's rifle barrel that had been there before poked back out.
Grab that thing, he said to Frank.
Frank didn't question the order, just reached up and closed his left hand around the metal tube. He jerked it out of the grip of the man inside. He heard a muffled curse. Kronsky flicked his lighter, lit the shortened fuse on the bundle, and casually tossed it, hookshot style, up and through the hole. Frank released the rifle and hit the ground. 3 seconds later, there was a thundercrack. Smoke and chunks of bloody flesh flew from the cutout window. 10. The earth trembled and gave an outraged roar. Clint, shoulder to shoulder with Willie Burke at the west wall, saw a tidal wave of tear gas curl from the parking lot, swept along by whatever had just exploded. Chimes rang through his skull and his joints vibrated. Beneath the noise, all he could think was that things were not going as well as he had hoped. These guys were going to kill Evie and all the rest of them. His fault. His failing. The pistol that he had been carrying around ridiculously, never once in their 15 years of marriage had he taken up Lila's invitation to go to the gun range with her, had nevertheless slid into his hand, begging to be fired. He leaned around Willie Burke, scanned the pileup at the front doors, and locked on the figure standing at the rear of the first bulldozer. This man was staring at the cloud of dust boiling from Rand Quigley's window, which had been, like everything else this morning, exploded out of its former normal shape. Jack Albertson had not expected the blast. It startled him, and he dropped his guard to look. While the chaos did not upset him, as a miner in his youth, one who had survived a good many rumbles in the earth, his nerves were cool. It did perplex him. What was wrong with these folks, that they would prefer a shootout to surrendering some damned wild woman to the law? In his view, the world got crazier and crazier with each passing year. His personal Waterloo had been Lila Norcross's election as chief of the dueling police department. A skirt in the chief's office. It didn't get much more ludicrous than that. Jack Albertson had put in his retirement papers there and then, and returned home to enjoy his lifelong bachelorhood in peace. Clint's arm lifted the pistol. The gun sight found the man behind the bulldozer, and Clint's finger pulled the trigger. The shot was followed by a succulent pop, the sound of a bullet punching through the faceplate of the man's gas mask. Clint saw the head snap back and the body crumple. Ah, Jesus, he thought. That was probably someone I knew.
Come on,
Willie cried, hauling him away to the rear door. Clint went, his legs doing what they needed to do. It had been easier than he might have guessed to kill someone, which only made it worse. Chapter 14. 1. When Jeanette opened her eyes, a fox was lying down outside the door to Evie's cell. Its snout rested on the fissured cement floor, from which ridges of green moss sprouted.
Tunnel, Jeanette said to herself,
Something about a tunnel. She said to the fox, Did I go through one? I don't remember if I did. Are you from Evie? It didn't answer, as she had almost expected it might. In dreams, animals could talk, and this felt like a dream, yet at the same time didn't. The fox only yawned, looked at her slyly, and pushed itself to its feet. A wing was empty, and a hole gaped in the wall. Beams of morning sunlight poured through. There was frost on the chunks of broken cement, beading and liquefying as the temperature rose. Jeanette thought, I feel awake again. I believe I am awake. The fox made a mewling noise and trotted to the hole. It glanced at Jeanette, mewled a second time, and went through and was swallowed by the light. 2. She gingerly picked her way through the hole, stooping under the sharp edges of gashed cement, and found herself in a field of knee-high weeds and dead sunflowers. The morning light made Jeanette squint. Her feet crunched frozen undergrowth, and the cool air raised goose flesh under the thin fabric of her uniform. The strong sensations of fresh air and sunshine awakened her completely. Her old body, exhausted by trauma and stress and lack of sleep, was a skin that had been shucked. Jeanette felt new. The fox cut briskly through the grass, taking her past the east side of the prison toward Route 31. Jeanette had to walk fast to keep up as her eyes adjusted to the sharp daylight. She flashed a glance at the prison. Naked brambles choked the walls. The rusted hump of a bulldozer and an RV were jammed against the front of the building, also thick with brambles. Extravagant clumps of yellow grass sprouted from cracks and gashes in the parking lot. Other rusted vehicles were stranded across the tarmac. Jeanette looked in the opposite direction. The fences were down. She could see flattened chain link glinting among the weeds. Although Jeanette couldn't make sense of the how or the why, she immediately absorbed the what. This was Dueling Correctional, but the world had spun on for years. Her guide continued up from the ditch that edged Route 31, crossed the cracked and disintegrating road, and entered the blue-green dark of the rising woods on the other side. As the fox ascended, his orange brush bobbed and flashed in the dimness. Jeanette ran across the road, keeping her eye on the flicking tail. One of her sneakers skated in a patch of damp, and she had to snatch for a branch to keep from losing her feet. The freshness of the air, tree sap and composting leaves and wet earth, burned down her throat and into her chest. She was out of prison, and a memory of playing Monopoly as a girl surfaced. Get out of jail free! This wondrous new reality excised the square of forest from time itself and made it an island beyond reach, of industrial cleaners, of orders, of jangling keys, of cellmate snores and farts, of cellmate crying, of cellmate sex, of cell doors banging shut, where she was the sole ruler, Queen Jeanette, evermore. It was sweet, sweeter even than she'd fantasized, to be free. But then, Bobby. She whispered it to herself. That was the name she had to remember, had to bring with her, so she would not be tempted to stay. 3. Judging distance was difficult for Jeanette. She was used to the level rubber track that circled the yard at the prison, each loop about half a mile. The steady southwest climb was more demanding than that, and she had to lengthen her strides, making her thigh muscles sing in a way that hurt and felt wonderful at the same time. The fox stopped once in a while to let her close some of the distance before he trotted on. She was sweating hard despite the chill. The air felt like that knife edge of time when winter teetered on the edge of spring. A few green-tipped buds flashed in the gray-brown of the woods, and where the earth was naked to the sky, it was squishy with melt. Maybe it was 2 miles, maybe 3, when the fox led Jeanette around the rear side of a fallen trailer beached in a sea of weeds. Ancient yellow police tape fluttered on the ground. She had an idea she was getting close now. She heard a faint buzz in the air. The sun was higher, and it was getting toward noon. She was starting to feel thirsty and hungry, and there might be something to eat and drink at her destination. How perfect a cold pop would be just now. But never mind. Bobby was what she needed to be thinking about. Seeing Bobby again. Ahead, the fox disappeared beneath an arch of broken trees. Jeanette hurried after, passing a pile of rubble wigged in weeds. It might once have been a small cabin or shed. Here, moths covered the branches of the trees, their countless tan bodies pressed together so that they resembled strange barnacles. Which followed, somehow, Jeanette thought, understanding innately that the world she found herself in was outside of all she had ever known, like a land at the bottom of the sea. The moths appeared still, but she could hear them crackling softly, as if speaking. "Bobby," they seemed to say. "It's not too late to start again," they seemed to say. The slope finally topped out. Through the last of the woods, Jeanette could see the fox standing in the faded grasses of a winter field. She sucked at the air. A kerosene scent, wholly unexpected and seemingly unattached to anything, tingled in her nose and mouth. Jeanette stepped into the open and saw something that could not be. Something that made her sure she was no longer in the Appalachian country she had always known. 4. It was a white tiger, coat tipped with black, fin-shaped markings. It rolled its head and roared, sounding like the MGM lion. Behind it soared a tree. A tree. Bursting up from the earth in a tangle of 100 trunks that twisted into a looming, sprawling fountain of branches, dripping with leaves and curling mosses, alive with the flitting bodies of tropical birds. A massive red snake, shining and glittering, coursed up the center. The fox trotted up to a gaping split in the bowl, tossed a somehow roguish look at Jeanette, and vanished into the depths. That was it. That was the tunnel that went both ways. The tunnel that would take her back to the world she had left, the one where Bobby waited. She started toward it. "Stop where you are, and raise your hands." A woman in a checked yellow button-down and blue jeans stood in grass that came up to her knees, pointing a pistol at Jeanette. She had come around the side of the tree, which was, at its base, roughly the size of an apartment building. In the hand that wasn't holding the pistol, she had a canister with a blue rubber band around its middle. "No closer. You're new, aren't you? And your clothes say you're from the prison. You must be confused." A peculiar smile touched Ms. Yellowshirt's lips, a futile attempt to soften the oddness of the situation. The tree, the tiger, the gun. "I want to help you. I will help you. We're all friends here. I'm Elaine, okay? Elaine Nutting. Just let me do this one thing and we'll talk more." "What thing?" Jeanette asked, although she was pretty sure she knew. Why else the kerosene stink? The woman was getting ready to light the impossible tree on fire. If it burned, the way back to Bobby burned. Evie had pretty much said so. It couldn't be allowed, but how was the woman to be stopped? She was at least 6 yards away, too far to rush her. Elaine went down on one knee, watching Jeanette carefully as she laid the pistol aside in the dirt, but close at hand, and quickly unscrewed the cap of the kerosene canister. "I already spread the first two around. I just need to finish making a circle, to be sure it'll go up." Jeanette took a couple of steps forward. Elaine snatched up the gun and got to her feet. "Stay back." "You can't do this," Jeanette said. "You have no right." The white tiger sat near the crevice that had absorbed the fox. It thumped its tail back and forth and watched with half-closed eyes of a brilliant amber. Elaine splashed kerosene against the tree, staining the wood a deeper brown. "I have to do this. It's better this way. It solves all the problems. How many men have hurt you?" "Plenty, I imagine. I've worked with women like you for my entire adult life.
I know you didn't just walk into prison on your own. A man pushed you.
Lady, Jeanette said, offended by the idea that one look at her could tell anyone anything that mattered. You don't know me.
Maybe not personally, but I'm right, aren't I? Elaine dumped the last of the kerosene onto some roots and pitched the canister aside. Jeanette thought, you ain't Elaine Nutting, you're Elaine Nuts.
There was a man who hurt me, yes, but I hurt him worse.
Jeanette took a step toward Elaine. She was about 15 feet away now.
I killed him.
Good for you, but don't come any closer. Elaine waved the pistol back and forth, as if she could brush Jeanette away, or erase her. Jeanette took another step.
Some people say he deserved it, even some who were his friends once.
Okay, they can believe that, but the DA didn't believe it.
More important, I don't believe it. Although it's true I wasn't in my right mind when it happened. And it's true that no one helped me when I needed help. So I killed him, and I wish I hadn't. It's on me, not him. I have to live with that. And I do.
Another step. Just a small one. I'm strong enough to take my share of the blame, okay? But I've got a son who needs me. He needs to know how to grow up right, and that's something I can teach him. I'm done being pushed around by anyone, man or woman. The next time Don Peters tries to get me to give him a hand job, I won't kill him, but I'll scratch his eyes out. And if he hits me, I'll keep right on scratching. I'm done being a punching bag. So you can take what you think you know about me, and you can shove it where the sun doesn't shine.
I believe you may have lost your mind, said Elaine.
Aren't there women here who want to go back?
I don't know.
Elaine's eyes shifted.
Probably, but they're misguided.
And you get to make that decision for them?
If no one else has the guts, Elaine said, with absolutely no awareness of how like her husband she sounded, then yes, in that case, it's down to me.
From the pocket of her jeans, she withdrew a long-barreled trigger lighter, the kind people use to fire up the coals in a barbecue. The white tiger was watching and purring, a deep rumbling sound like an idling engine. It didn't look to Jeanette as if there would be any help from that direction.
Guess you don't have any kids, huh? Jeanette asked.
The woman looked hurt. I have a daughter. She's the light of my life.
And she's here?
Of course she is. She's safe here, and I intend to keep her that way.
What does she say about that?
What she says doesn't matter. She's just a child.
Okay, what about all the women who had to leave boy children behind? Don't they have a right to raise their kids and keep them safe? Even if they do like it here, don't they have that responsibility?
See, Elaine said, smirking. That statement alone is enough to tell me you're foolish. Boys grow up to be men, and it's men who cause all the trouble. They're the ones who shed the blood and poison the earth. We are better off here. There are male babies here, yes, but they're going to be different. We'll teach them to be different.
She took a deep breath. The smirk spread, as if she were inflating it with crazy gas.
This world will be kind.
Let me ask you again. You mean to close the door on the life all them other ladies left behind without even asking them?
Elaine's smile faltered.
They might not understand, so I'm making...
What are you making, lady?
Besides a mess.
Jeanette slid her hand in her pocket. The fox reappeared and sat beside the tiger. The red snake slithered weightily across one of Jeanette's sneakers, but she did not so much as look down. These animals did not attack, she understood. They were from what some preacher, back in the dim days of her optimistic, church-going childhood, had called the peaceable kingdom. Elaine flicked the lighter's switch. Flame wavered from the tip.
I am making an executive decision.
Jeanette pulled her hand from her pocket and hurled a handful of peas at the other woman. Elaine flinched, raised her hand with the gun in an instinctive motion of defense, and stepped back.
Jeanette closed the remaining distance and caught her around the waist. The gun tumbled from Elaine's hand and fell into the dirt. She hung on to the lighter, though. Elaine stretched, the flame at the tip curling toward the knot of kerosene-dampened roots. Jeanette banged Elaine's wrist against the ground. The lighter slipped from her hand and went out, but too late. Guttering blue flames danced along one of the roots, moving up toward the trunk. The red snake slithered up the tree, wanting away from the fire. The tiger rose, lazily, went to the burning root, and planted a paw on it. Smoke rose around the paw, and Jeanette smelled singeing fur, but the tiger remained planted. When it stepped away, the blue flames were gone. The woman was weeping as Jeanette rolled off her.
"I just want Nana to be safe. I just want her to grow up safe."
"I know." Jeanette had never met this woman's daughter and probably never would, but she recognized the sound of true pain, spirit pain. She had experienced plenty of that herself. She picked up the barbecue lighter, examined it. Such a small tool to close the door between two worlds. It might have worked, if not for the tiger. Was it supposed to do that? Jeanette wondered. Or had it gone beyond its purview? And if that was so, would it be punished? So many questions, so few answers. Never mind. She whipped her arm in a circle and watched the barbecue lighter go spinning away. Elaine gave a cry of despair as it disappeared into the grass 40 or 50 feet distant. Jeanette bent and picked up the pistol, meaning to put it in her belt, but of course she was wearing her inmate browns and had no belt. Belts were a no-no. Inmates sometimes hung themselves with belts if they had them. There was a pocket in her drawstring pants, but it was shallow and still half full of peas. The gun would fall right out. What to do with it? Throwing it away seemed to be the wisest course. Before she could do that, leaves rustled behind her. Jeanette swung around with the pistol in her hand. "Hey, drop it! Drop the gun!" At the edge of the wood stood another armed woman, her own pistol trained on Jeanette. Unlike Elaine, this one held her weapon in both hands and with her legs planted wide, as if she knew what she was doing. Jeanette, no stranger to orders, started to lower the gun, meaning to put it in the grass beside the tree, but a prudent distance away from Elaine Nutball, who might make a grab for it. As she bent, the snake rustled along the branch above her. Jeanette flinched and raised the hand holding the gun to protect her head from a half-glimpsed falling object. There was a crack, then a faint tink, two coffee mugs clicking together in a cabinet. And she seemed to hear Evie in her head, an inarticulate cry of mingled pain and surprise. After that, Jeanette was on the ground. The sky was nothing but leaves, and there was blood in her mouth. The woman with the gun came forward. The muzzle was smoking, and Jeanette understood she had been shot.
"Put it down," the woman ordered.
Jeanette opened her hand, not knowing she still held the pistol until it rolled free.
"I know you,"
Jeanette whispered. It felt as if there was a large, warm weight on her chest. It was hard to breathe, but it didn't hurt.
"You were the one who brought Evie to the prison. The cop. I seen you through the window."
"That smells like kerosene," Lila said. She picked up the overturned canister, sniffed at it, then dropped it. Outside that morning's meeting at the Shopwell, someone had mentioned that one of the golf carts was missing, and no one had signed the register for it. A girl named Maisie Wettermore had volunteered that she had seen Elaine Nutting just a few minutes earlier, driving one in the direction of Adam's lumberyard. Lila, who had come with Janice Coates, had exchanged a glance with the ex-warden. There were only two things in the direction of Adam's lumberyard these days: the desiccated ruins of a meth lab, and the tree. It had worried both of them, the idea of Elaine Nutting going out there alone. Lila had remembered Elaine's doubts about the animals there, the tiger especially, and it occurred to her that she might try to kill it. This, Lila was certain, would be unwise. So the two of them had taken out a golf cart of their own and followed. And now Lila had shot a woman she had never seen before,
who lay bleeding on the ground, badly wounded.
"What the hell were you going to do?" she asked.
"Not me," Jeanette said, and looked over at the weeping woman. "Her. She was the one. Her kerosene. Her gun. I stopped her."
Jeanette knew she was dying. Coldness like well water rising up through her, taking away her toes, then the rest of her feet, then her knees, slipping up toward the heart of her. Bobby had been afraid of water when he was little. And Bobby had been afraid someone was going to take his Coke and his Mickey Mouse hat. That was the moment captured in the photo on her little block of paint in the cell. "No, honey, no," she had told him. "Don't you worry. Those are yours. Your mother's not going to let anyone take them from you." And if Bobby were here now, asking about this water that his mother was sinking down into? Oh, she'd tell him. "That's nothing to worry about either. It's just a shock at first, but you get used to it." But Jeanette was no lying for prizes champion. She wasn't that caliber of contestant. She might have been able to get a fib past Bobby, but not Ree. If Ree had been there, she'd have had to admit, though the well water didn't hurt, it didn't feel right either. She could hear the host's disembodied voice. "That's all for Jeanette Sorley, I'm afraid, but we're sending her home with some lovely parting gifts. Tell her about them, Can." The host sounded like Warner Wolf, Mr. Let's Go to the Videotape himself. Hey, if you had to be sent home, you couldn't ask for a better announcer. Warden Coates, her hair now as white as chalk, interrupted Jeanette's sky. It kind of suited her, the hair. She was too thin, though. Big dents under her eyes, hollows at her cheeks. "Sorley?" Coates went to a knee and took her hand. "Jeanette?" "Oh, shit," the cop said. "I think I just made a very bad mistake." She dropped to her knees and put her palms against Jeanette's wound, applying pressure, knowing it was pointless. "I only meant to wing her, but the distance, and I was so afraid for the tree. I'm sorry." Jeanette felt blood leaking from both corners of her mouth. She began to gasp. "I have a son. His name is Bobby. I have a son." Jeanette's last words were directed at Elaine, and the last thing she saw was that woman's face, her wide, scared eyes. "Please, I have a son."